Literature from the Land today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Bob Banks' novels and short stories are rooted in rural Iowa. We'll meet him today on Scribble. Bob, how long has your family and you been in farming?
150 years this year.
You don't look that old.
But I know. My great-great-grandfather started out in 1868.
Same farm?
Same farm.
Wow.
Same farm family.
Where's your farm located?
We're 3 miles east of Bluegrass, Iowa.
Oh, yeah, I've probably driven right by the
Probably place. Have. We're a little south of the pavement, but our land goes to the pavement, to the 61. Yes.
And yours is a lot bigger than my wife's farm, but not 5,000 acres like many of them have today.
No.
My wife grew up on a 200-acre farm, and they made a perfectly good living on that, which you don't do anymore, right?
No, they don't. And I started out on 280.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. And expanded to 640 now.
And have you always raised cattle?
No, I actually was a hog farmer.
Okay.
Mortgage lifters.
I raise hogs. My book was written by a cattle farmer, so I wouldn't get connected as a bio on my life. So I made sure of that.
Yeah, a lot of people around don't like hog farmers.
Well, there is
my wife's cousins. Raise, but they raise them 4,000 at a time or 8,000 at a time.
Oh.
And you walk by there and it smells.
Well, it's not a delicate business.
No, but I don't mind this.
It's the smell of money, but then they say, but even now when I drive by a hog farm, I think, gee, that smells. And I was smelled that way for years and didn't even know it.
Right.
When did you retired, you say?
I retired in 2008.
And is that when you started writing, or has this been a bad habit long before that?
That's when I actually started writing things down, put it that way. I did a few church skits and stuff like that just for the fun of it. And I started looked at a magazine one time, and there was an article that you could write a short story for a magazine.
Okay.
And I thought, that'd be fun. Because I had all these ideas in my head from sitting in a combine too long. And I started the story out, and it got to 20,000 words, and I wasn't even close to finishing what my thoughts were. And pretty soon it was 40,000 words, and then in the end I got up to a novel is around 80,000 words, and I had my first book. Then I say, what do I do with this? I had it edited. I did have an editor. I always had somebody edit it, and they thought, first-time editor, for me. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, if the beginning and the end was great, now if we can do something in the middle, we will have a book. And I worked with him for probably almost a year. Tried the traditional route of going to an agent and all this, and then wasn't so successful. I have my little file of rejection letters that everybody gets.
Yeah. Actually, you can paper a wall with them, right?
Yes. And I actually went to a writer's conference, and one of the speakers said, if you want to publish a book, and if you really, it's not really your business, self-publish it. And that's what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have my books published, and the very first time I even tried it, the publishing company said, you get 35 free. Not really, but you get 35 back. Right. And I thought, I got enough relatives. I can give those away. But it's been, in my eyes, very successful in this area. I don't it's not a million seller, not even 1,000. Well, it is 1,000 seller. It's sold 2,000 or 3,000 copies.
Wow.
That's probably been Very successful from my, in my mind.
So do you do readings and book signings and things?
I do book signings. Don't do a reading. I've never really read much out of it, but I do book signings here and there. And a lot of my sites sell at are probably the darndest places people even think of. I got one in a drugstore in a small town in Iowa, in Durant, and in Bluegrass, where I'm from, I got it at a feed mill, or you know, and so I sell, do a lot of things at church bazaars and places like that. That I'll buy a booth, you know, and sign books.
You know, it kind of becomes an industry, doesn't it? Once you get to writing and self-publishing and then self-promotion, you're working pretty steadily.
Yes, I can be. Yes. Yeah. And I enjoy that part. I enjoy the signings because I love to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And you may catch that here this morning even. I love to talk to people. I love to talk. I wish I could speak more. Go to give speeches. I never have done that, but I'd like to
so
try it.
So those endless hours on the combine when there's nobody to talk to, you talk to yourself, right? And thought up these ideas, I take it, that ended up being novels occurred long before you actually started writing.
The first one did. First two did. Really. The first one is a romantic novel. Now, if you think a guy who wrote farm for 48 years can write a romantic novel, especially as a farmer, I did it. I think that one led to the next one because in that novel, the lady's husband, I have heroines instead of heroes. I've written – all my books have strong women characters in them, and her husband dies fairly young, and so – my small fan club that I have said, "What happened to Sarah?" And so that was the basis of my next book, of what happened to her after her first husband died. And it takes her through her life for the next 10, 12 years.
You've written how many novels?
I've written 5 novels. And the last book that I've written, I guess, is an anthology of short stories that I have accumulated over the years. Everything from way back to when I was in junior college, in my first essay I ever wrote for an English teacher.
So you actually have been writing a good long time.
Yeah, I guess so in that kind of sense, yes. Yes, I have.
I constantly am talking to writers about that, you know, that writers seem to write from early on. It becomes a mode of expression where most of us would convey our ideas in conversation and so on. Writers feel a compulsion to write things down. And it looks as if you've been a writer all your life, even though you were distracted by farming.
Probably have. You're probably right there, Don. I'm probably, I think about it, yes. The other thing is that I came from an era where there were one-room schools, mm-hmm. and I tend to write. I have a whole section of my file on that. I haven't got it written down and printed yet, but one-room country schools are a rarity, and those who are still alive to have gone to one are also a rarity, and I would like to get that written down sometime so people can realize what life was when we had one-room schools.
Yeah, that's true. It's rare to find them anymore. They're of historic interest. Although I hear there are a few scattered around the country that are still in operation.
Well, several big schools try to emulate the country school. My wife went to country school, too, where in some ways the sixth graders taught the second graders.
Okay.
And they discovered that, you know, by having sixth graders do the teaching, they learn a lot. So I don't know that that's been successful, but, you know, that's one advantage of a country school is that, you know, everybody sort of taught everybody else.
That's interesting because I thought it was kind of freakish that in my school we had 60 kids in a class. From the fourth grade on, I taught. That was my chore because I was a quick learner. And so the fourth through the eighth grade, yeah, I was teaching along with the nun. So I guess that, and it's true, that is absolutely correct. If you're going to teach something, boy, do you have to know it. You really learn in a hurry. But can you read us something just so we get a flavor of what your writing is like?
I'll try here. This is from my very first book that I published in 2008.
Okay, we'll start at the beginning.
I wrote in 2000, published in 2010. And this is the book is called The Nightgown, a Rural Love Story. And it goes, Sarah reached into the top drawer of the old dresser, her hands tanned and wrinkled from more than a quarter of a century of farm work, pulling out a tattered, yellowed Peterson's department store box. She opened the lid gently and folded the paper surrounding the white cotton nightgown, with lace around the top and buttons down to the waist. It had held up well, she had thought, considering it was more than 60 years old. She carried it, loving, to the bedroom window and sat down by the old rocker. As she sat down, a card sifted to the floor. Sarah picked it up and read, Mr. and Mrs. John McWilliams invited you to attend the wedding of their daughter, Sarah Jane, to Paul William Moss, and son of Mr. and Mrs. George Moss, July 6, 1975, at the First Church of Christ in Muscatine, Iowa.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. You start with a scene that involves recollection, and I guess the novel goes back to that, huh?
But also we know something's going to happen, right?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, I mean, that. Where did you learn to write that way? No, I mean,
I'm going to say that came from my one almost failed course at tech journalism in Iowa State. I took one course at Iowa State, and the only reason I took it was because it was a Tuesday-Thursday course, and that fit in my class schedule. And it was an interesting course, but the teacher or the prof said, your first paragraph, you want to grab your reader. And if you're reading a newspaper or a magazine article, you want to tell everything in the first couple paragraphs. Otherwise, they aren't going to read it. Mm-hmm. And I guess I've employed that thing in all my novels. They call them the hook. I think it's basically what the term is. And I like to hook my readers into that within a page. Otherwise, they're not going to read the book.
But you do it in the way all of us writing teachers teach people to write. You show rather than tell, right? We see the nightgown, we see something fall out of it, and we know that something has happened. And instead of you having to just enumerate the whole thing, and that's what makes that writing, I think, that's the hook that brings the readers in.
So you had that right at the beginning.
Yeah.
the beginning and the end, and you had to work on the middle.
The middle, right. The middle was something, yes, that's basically what it is.
Are you still writing?
Yes. Oh, yes. I've sort of got into the habit now, and I have a seventh novel about halfway through it. This one is taking a little longer. I was punching them out about once every 13, 14 months, but this one, I set it in the time period of the 1920s around World War I. And I've had to do a little more research. Instead of my brain, I had to research some of the it's still a rural story. But the equipment that was used in that era, and what kind of the housing they had, you know, it was before electricity in the rural areas, and how they handled this. It's and not too many people are around that can tell me, so I have to do research on that, how that happened.
You said that these ideas come to you while driving a combine or a tractor. And I've done the same kind of thing. I used to love summer jobs like detasseling corn, where you could do it almost mindlessly and meanwhile think. You know, I would try to think up poems. Well, I was never very good at it. I'm not as good as you are at that. But that's and I based the labels on 5-gallon paint cans one summer, and I thought up all kinds of story ideas because you didn't have to think about it. And the same thing, you know, you have to think a little more when you're going down a row combining or plowing or something. Can you take us through the process a little more? What idea came first, and then was it the character, the situation, or what?
Isn't your wife named Sarah?
No.
No. Okay.
My wife's name is Jane.
Okay.
And she, in fact, on the one of the books, her picture's on the front of the book. It was the second one book written.
I saw that, and I knew her name was Sarah. That's why I made that jump.
Yeah, this is a thing in doing things for trying to find a bright cover. I could not find a woman of of mature age on a phone, because I have a lady in Ankeny that does my graphics, and she couldn't come over there, and she's a young lady. And so I took a photo of Jane and sent it out to her, and she says, "We don't need any more." And this is where that picture came from.
Wow.
So that's another thing. Now, back to your question. What was it? How do I start this whole thing?
Yeah, what pops into your mind?
What my thought process? The first one was, I dreamt that thing up, a nightgown. I had the nightgown in my mind. And I don't know what I was trying to be, R-rated or what. But, you know, I had this in my mind that this nightgown was a special. And if you read the book, it's only worn on the night of the wedding anniversary.
Okay.
And it has a magical powers that things happen at that anniversary date. And sometimes they aren't good magical powers, or something bad happens, but that's how I got started on that. And it just kept growing. And my wife tells me that my mind never shuts off. And that probably is a very true statement. I can write. I'm probably writing, sitting here talking to you two guys, and I'm probably thinking of something backer than what's going to come up in the next story I'm going to write. I love to think. I love stories.
Yeah.
So at the end of a day way back then, even before you started actually writing the novel, did you take notes or jot things down? Or
nope, it's all up in my head. I have, you know, that's the reason I'm hurrying to write now, because I might want to lose this in my hard drive up here. You know.
So how many words would you say you get per acre?
You know, that's the thing that has always fascinated me. All of us store up things in our minds.
Right.
And you just keep adding and adding, and things drift out, you know, but you can retrieve them. And then you die and all that's gone. And you think, all that storage, all right. that space, all that information, gone. And but we do it. We just keep accumulating information. You are very practical, Bob, because you're using it. You're putting it in printed form. That's good.
I've had so many people come to me when I'm at a book signing, and they say, "I just can't write," or "I don't know what to write." I said, "Everybody has stories. Our life is a whole story."
Yeah,
and that's right.
Everybody has even their childhood stories. Everybody, even lived in town or you lived in the country, you had something going on that's a story. And I don't care. Everybody has a story, even though if you only worked in a factory all your life, and you think, "I didn't do anything." But what'd you do when you weren't working? You know, there's some things that we don't realize it.
The thing that has always stopped me is a natural reticence. I don't want to tell people about my life. You know, I don't want to tell, particularly not intimate things. And with a writer, I'm told that writers are ruthless that way. They take everything there is around them and they use it. Is that true of you?
I would probably say that. And and that's what's good about fiction, because you can fake it to a certain degree, you know. And sure, there are some things in some of my novels that relate to my life, but of course they're different characters. I put them in a little different situation, and it isn't a bio of my life at all.
But that's true. You have to have some kind of framework to build a story on, and your own experiences and your own imagination provide that frame.
Correct.
Yeah.
So when you actually finally sit down to write the story that's already in your head, does it change a lot? I mean, does the story kind of get away from you, or do you pretty much know what you're kind of going to say the whole
time? I have an outline, and okay. I do have it written down somewhere. And it starts out well. It does sometimes doesn't end out. And basically, what happens, I never get to the end of the outline because my story fills in too many times in between. These stories come up, and I say, "Oh, that's a good story." And of course, I bought many stories that I write, and then I have to delete the whole thing. Good thing for computers, you can just delete the thing.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything to the story. It doesn't lead to the story to go on forward. It just is something that, oh yes, that sounds a good story, but it doesn't really mean anything. So you don't need 10,000 words on a story, and it doesn't mean anything. So you just delete it.
You use a computer?
Oh yes. Yeah. Yes. I couldn't be doing this if I had to write, or even had the old typewriter thing that, yes, I grew up with. We're old enough, all three of us, that we knew what a typewriter and whiteouts and all that kind of stuff was. And
When I found out when I was forced to use a computer because my typewriter died, I discovered, I can move things around. I can shift paragraphs. I can go back and delete and add. And I thought, this is magic.
Yes. And that's the thing about even the internet, with, because my graphics designer is in Ankeny. I had my editor for a while was in the state of Washington. She lived up by Spokane. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, click, 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 and it's out there, you know, and click, click back, and then it it's.
What are the names of your novels so our listeners can look them up?
The first one is called The Nightgown.
Okay.
A rural love story. The second was called Call Sarah, which is a sequel of the first one. The third one was called The Fourth Generation, which is about the children of the couple in the first two stories. And it's just that one is stories about growing up rural. Mm-hmm. You don't get to go down the street and play ball. You have to make up your own games, and you have this. But if you're rural, I changed my genre then and went to one called Iowa Exposed. This is a cops and robbers thing. The cops and robbers is set in Muscatine County, corrupt sheriff department, and then it moves to Loiza County, or town of Wapello, where there's a packing plant that's the front for a prostitution ring. So it has several avenues going for you. And then the main characters in that book were, of course, the DCI agents. And they quit the party department. They had enough of it after the first one. And she is from Maquoketa. And she moves to Maquoketa. And the story about how she recovered back in Maquoketa and her old boyfriend finds out, and he stalks her, and that's how that story goes through. And my last one is called Oak Tree Tales, which is 11 short stories, everything from one that's only 600 words long, which is my very first one I ever wrote, to a couple that are 15,000-20,000 words long that are fairly recent in my mind, all over the board where they're at in that – anything rural about them. They're from North Carolina to Vermont to out in Colorado. You know, it's different stories. And that's the six books that I've written.
Well, now, these are available at drugstores, farm feed stores, and where else?
The book rack over in Davenport is probably the one for the Quad Cities. They carry my books.
You on Amazon?
I'm on Amazon. I'm on Kindle. Mm-hmm. You can get Kindle with Amazon. That's okay. That's a way you can get through that way.
And the author is Bob Banks, B-A-N-C-K-S.
Correct.
Okay, I found out the hard way that I was spelling your name wrong.
Yes, that's very easily done.
Bob, thank you very much. You are having a very productive retirement, and just keep it up.
Okay, thank you very much.
I must say that Bob Banks is fun to talk to.
He is. Sounds like he is having a great time in retirement.
That's true. And he said he likes to talk. Invite him to give a talk wherever you are, Muscatine, because that's where anywhere.
Well, just before we went on the air, he said most farmers are simply cannot let the farm go.
Yeah. Right?
And he, 8 years ago, retired. And he said that's very – and it is. It's very unusual.
It is, but you know, retirement is always a dicey thing. I played with it for a long time. I resolved that I was going to work until I dropped. And but circumstances meant that I had to retire from the radio station, and because of Bernadette's problems, I retired from all my volunteer stuff. I withdrew from the Genesis Guild. That was a painful retirement.
That took a while.
That did. But now it's complete. and retiring from the station. Well, obviously,
I haven't done that yet.
Well, I'm only here on Saturday when nobody else is around, so I don't want to be the ghost of Banquo anywhere. So I don't bother the guild at all, nor the station. But you really have to keep working at something. It's important. If you just stop and start idling or playing, your life ends. And you ought to keep going right to the end. And he obviously has found something to energize him and keep him active. And that's good.
It is.
Yeah, 5 books. Yeah. Well, tweet.
Yeah. Well, I know.
All that idle time when you've been storing up plots in your mind.
I know. But I've been reading books to recommend for Scribble.
Oh, I see. Well, recommend one.
Well, this is a really interesting book. I can't even say it's a good book, but it's one that Nan Carter sent. She sends me about 3 books a week.
Oh, dear.
But this is one by an Egyptian writer, Sonala Ibrahim, Ibrahim, called That Smell.
That Smell?
That Smell. And it is, he was imprisoned for, it was sentenced to 7 years at hard labor at the age of 25 for being a member of the Communist Party, and was freed after 5 years. And meanwhile, during the imprisonment, he came across not Hemingway, but a biography of Hemingway. And from what he could gather about Hemingway's style, he decided for Egyptian currently, this would make a good style in contrast to the rich style of most Egyptian writers. You know, just matter of fact, bare bones, nothing. He had never read Hemingway because he couldn't get a hold of a copy. And so he sat down to write this little 150-page book based upon a man who is just freed from an Egyptian prison who is aimless and wanders here and there. And what you get is life in Egypt told as if Hemingway were on steroids. I mean, it outdoes Hemingway in the Hemingway style. Uh-huh. And it really is a very good book. And I just read a story in the Wall Street Journal that you walk into a contemporary bookstore like Barnes & Noble's, only 3% of the books there are in translation. We have so little idea of other cultures.
Yeah. So it's called That
Smell. That Smell.
THAT.
Yeah.
SMELL.
That's it.
That Smells by Ibrahim.
Right. It's a smell of a prison.
Well, I imagine that would be a distinctive smell.
But it is. It has no plot. It doesn't go anywhere. Nothing connects. But if you want to read somebody who is trying to imitate Hemingway in a whole different culture, under whole different circumstances, this is a short, very interesting book, available on Amazon, as everything else is. Really good.
Okay, well, with that, I think we will draw the curtain for another session. And we're happy to have had Bob Banks with us today, and we recommend you read That Smell by Ibrahim. And we'll be back next week for another session of Scribble.